This show is part of the RetroZap.com podcast network.
Hey, yeah, you. Did you know that Arcast is on Patreon? Go check out patreon.com/arcast for ways to help out the show and get some sweet perks in return. It could be something small, such as our $1 tier to show your support, or join one of our higher tiers to get a shout out, pick an episode topic, or even be a part of the show as a special guest. Even just sharing our show to your friends goes a long way. Once again, that's patreon.com/arcast. Thanks for helping us, and keep it retro. What's up, Argonauts, and welcome to another Retro Gaming Podcast. This is episode 190 of the R-Cast. I am your host, David Gilton, and with me is a man who is secretly Doomguy under the helmet, Robert Workman.
Well, you'd be angry, too, if you were playing that game that you featured with the water and the rings from the one where you push the buttons to try to get the rings on the hooks. We advertised that on our social channel, and that game pissed me off.
It's hard mode.
So, yeah, I'm in the mood to smash a few demons. That's how it works.
You know? Right.
But, no, this week, David, we are discussing all things handheld gaming, the evolution of handhelds, and, like, we're talking, like, systems that had great games. Obviously, Game Boy comes to mind, PlayStation Vita. We're going to be talking about all that. But we have a great guest on our show who's going to be talking all that with us. Who do we have?
Yes, so with us is Brian Crescente, who is the founder of Kotaku and co-founder of Polygon, and he's done, like, so many other things, but he's a very credited writer and just, like, person in the industry. So how's it going there, Brian?
Hey, guys, how's it going?
Going good, going good. We're, like, really happy to have you on, and, like, especially to talk about, like, handheld consoles and history. So definitely, like, a lot to cover. We did recently have a Nintendo handhelds episode not too long ago, so we'll definitely be giving, like, some more, you know, some more love to, like, the other non-Nintendo consoles out there, but we'll definitely mention some Nintendo here and there, obviously. But first, we want to hit the news here, starting off with PlayStation skipping E3 again this year, the second year in a row. So we've talked about this a few times, like, on the, on like the podcast about, like, how, E3 kind of seems to be, like, on its last legs, or that they're, like, really struggling now, like, with, like, other conventions kind of picking up the slack and, like, you know, having, like, companies basically, controlling, like, their own narrative, their own messaging, really, like, to their audiences, as opposed to relying on E3. And, the ESA seems to be in a bit of trouble there. There's a Sony spokesperson here who told GamesIndustry.biz, who says, "We have great respect for the ESA as an organization, but we do not feel the vision of E3 2020 is the right venue for what we are focused on this year." Which I have to, you know, throw in a little rebuttal there. I do not think they have great respect for the ESA, especially with how they've been handling a lot of people's information out there as of late.
Yeah, don't mind me. But there's two sides of this. The first, of course, is, you know, what the ESA is doing in terms of nothing when it comes to that leak that took place, like, last year, and a lot of data, and it leaves a lot of the future of the event in question. But there's also other companies that have stepped forward, and they're still supporting E3. Microsoft, they'll said they'll be there with Xbox Series X. Tommy Tallarico said he'll have playable kiosks within television. And Nintendo is pretty much a lock because they like doing Treehouse broadcasts there. They're going to have Switch Pro, maybe, and a bunch of games. So, I mean, the E3 is still going to happen. It's still going to be the home for many great activations, as ESA puts it, for some reason, in their response. That's one of the things they mentioned. I don't know. But there is one good thing that comes out of this, is that somewhere, I'm guessing, Sony is going to bring back a show that you and I both love, David, the PlayStation Experience event. I have a feeling that this is a key opportunity for them to bring it back, to host something for the fans and the press alike, to see the PlayStation 5 games, what they're made of, whatever's coming to PlayStation 4, obviously Ghost of Tsushima and The Last of Us Part 2 are still on the way. So, I mean, it sounds like sometime, maybe this summer, maybe a little later, we'll see that event to really let the PS5 shine. Because they said they were hosting hundreds of events, consumer events, to show off the PS5, which, you know, to them, they can afford it. And it seems like, you know, an ideal event for them. But
it's a big year.
We do have the good with the PlayStation Experience coming back, but we do have to question, what's going to happen with E3? Well, at least there'll be more energy drink trucks like last year.
That's true. Yeah, bigger booths for them.
I remember that. Like, Will Powers, one of our guests who was on a show a while back, he showed a picture like a year ago, and there was a gigantic truck that looked like a dance party, and there were just people handing out energy drinks. This was on the show floor. You know, not outside like usual. So I don't know. To me, I think E3's got a lot of work to do to win that respect back, but there is going to be something for the show this year for those that want to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also, you look at, so last year was obviously, it was the first year that Sony didn't attend. I actually broke that story when it came out. What was interesting was at the time, SIE said that they were going to have this big lineup of titles and that they would be doing a lot of consumer events. But look at last year. Not only did they not do the PlayStation experience last year, but I can't think of any PlayStation events that really happened last year. So obviously there's got to be something that they do to show off the PlayStation 5. But I would assume they're doing PlayStation experience, but I think right now that's just an assumption because they obviously have changed the way they're sort of playing around with the way they're presenting information. I think the first reveal of the PlayStation 5 was interesting. It was through a Wired article.
Interesting is a word, yeah.
Yes, and it highlighted the fact that the console was going to have an SSD, which I think is a weird thing to be, you know, to be the sort of crown jewel of that article. So I don't know. I think we have to wait and see. We saw signs of PlayStation or Sony Interactive Entertainment sort of taking a step toward what Nintendo's been doing in the past with its live directs, but they don't seem fully invested in that either. So I think it may be too early to say that there's definitely an experience coming.
Yeah, maybe not the experience that we were hoping for, but you know, it could be like any number of things. I mean, I was kind of like guessing that they were holding back on events last year, knowing that the PlayStation 5 was going to be coming out this year. You know, and just kind of like figure out like what they're going to be doing, like whether it's going to be like a PlayStation experience or maybe something along those lines, maybe another direct, maybe like, you know, like all that together along with some other things, who knows. But there is definitely going to be some major like marketing campaign that's going to be rolling out for the PlayStation 5 as, you know, as it's going to be coming out later this year. And we'll see like what that looks like. It would be nice to see like, see PlayStation experience come back again. That'd be really, really cool because, I really enjoyed that event, honestly. I mean, we'll kind of wait and see on that. So,
One other thing I wanted to mention. I don't know if you guys follow Michael Futter on Twitter.
We've had him on the show before, actually. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So he was, I think yesterday, or maybe it was today, was talking about, he had heard that the PlayStation 5's full unveil was going to be initially, he said, something teaming up with a, retailer. And then he changed it. He updated it to say it was a distributor, which has me scratching my head because I'm not quite sure in North America, at least, what distributor, like that's there aren't a lot of really out there distributors. who aren't retailers. So I'm not sure. I think we're in for something very different.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess we'll wait and see on that. But before we move on from the story, though, Brian, I was kind of curious on your take with, with like where E3, I guess, like stands within the industry and what it needs to do in order to survive if it is going to survive at all.
I mean, I think you guys said it, you know, it's struggling. Last year was, frankly, abysmal. The show floor was, they were kind of half empty. They had events. Microsoft was doing some really cool stuff, but not on the show floor. EA did some cool stuff in the lead up to the week of E3. PlayStation wasn't there. Activision only really had two games to show. So it was like a really sparse event. Historically, you would expect that this would be a massive E3 because of the console launches. But again, you know, PlayStation's not going to be there. I'm sure Microsoft is to some degree going to take advantage of that, but they're not going to double, they're not going to take up all that space. I don't know. I think we're seeing a lot of interesting things going on right now. You know, you've got the Coliseum with Jeff Keighley, which I think is sort of one of the highlights of the show now, at least for people who pay to go. I don't know. I kind of feel like, and I may have floated this idea before, I kind of feel like maybe it's time for the ESA to let E3 go. Like, sell it to Keighley, sell it to Reed Pop,
pasture, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think E3 could survive, but I don't know if ESA is the organization to keep running it.
That's fair,
I think that you hand it to someone who that's all they do, and then the ESA can reinvest in what it really is meant to do. You know, it's got a couple of jobs, one of which is to sort of highlight video games. But I think we're at a point in time where that's maybe not as important, and that's sort of the E3 stuff. So maybe they could double down on lobbying and education instead of worrying about hosting this big sort of celebration of games.
Right.
And regarding Microsoft, more than likely they'll probably do what they did last year. They'll probably have some sort of mixer presence on the show floor, but with obviously a bigger booth, but they'll have their little Microsoft thing next door, so the floor isn't too crowded with everybody who wants to see Xbox Series X.
Well, it makes sense too, since like they've been putting more of a focus on like streamers and like YouTubers and like that basically, instead of like the traditional media like within the industry. So it would make sense in that regard for sure. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we wanted to touch on here is in regards to Super Nintendo World. So a little bit of a happier news story here. There's like some more details came out from like Universal Studios in regards to Super Nintendo World, which is basically going to be like the Nintendo themed part of the park, basically. And how they're going to be adding in these bands, basically, for like attendees to wear. So these bands are basically going to allow you to collect digital coins and compete against other attendees of the park, basically. And so there's going to be like a smartphone app attached to it. You're going to be able to use that smartphone app as, you know, as like an overhead map, basically, very Zelda style, I guess, in order to kind of move around the map and find attractions and, I guess, find more of these like digital coins and maybe like come across like challenges or whatever to do. So it's meant to be very like interactive in that sense. I'm kind of curious if this is going to be like an AR sort of thing. I wasn't sure like what you thought about that, Robert.
You know, I really want to go. I'll be honest here. You know, the wristbands.
I mean, there's
look
that.
Pretty,
yeah,
they look pretty awesome, and it sounds like, you know, the Mario Kart and Yoshi's Adventure rides are going to be cool. And mm-hmm. I mean, let's be honest, the music video they released is incredibly catchy. You know, how are we going to deny that?
It is, and it does give like a little bit of a hint of what we might be able to expect. But I mean, in regards to like these bands and like what you're actually going to be doing in the park, aside from like what we know is going to be there, I was kind of curious on, I guess, like what you think is going to be. I don't know, the thing that really sets us apart, aside from within the Nintendo IPs and all that.
People like interaction. You know, Disney has proven that with their parks in the past, with their little wristbands and everything. So, I mean, that's exactly what Universal and Nintendo are going for here. They want a level of interaction. It could be AR related, but they also said you could bring your Switch and do stuff with that. So, I mean, they didn't say specifically what, but probably like a map download or at the very least some bonus theme? I don't know. There's a number of things they could do. They haven't clarified at all. But, I mean, they're really going all out to just try to create something that's fun for families and all that. And honestly, I'm excited for it. I mean, this is actually the first theme park that caters to all ages of gaming fans. You know, yeah, I mean, the kids are going to absolutely go bonkers for Mario, but you're telling me that people that played Mario in the 80s aren't going to, oh, we're going. We're booking a trip. Let's go to Japan.
Oh, of course. You know, yeah, yeah. It's going to get those people first.
Yeah. So it's really great. All it's a win all around. And, you know, it's still a mystery how they're going to incorporate all this technology, but I mean, it really sounds like a dream come true. Now, obviously, it's going to be expensive, I'm guessing, because this tech does not come cheap, but you know, it's going to be
Universal Studios as well.
Yeah. You can go to Harry Potter next door when you're done. I'm really eager to see what it has to offer, and I'm looking forward to more details.
For sure. Brian, do you have your tickets ready for this?
No, I do think it's got a lot of potential. I really kind of had hoped that video they released, my hope had been that they were going to have something that was real. I mean, I love it. It was sort of like a color video to give you a sense of what they're going for. But I was hoping that we'd get a glimpse of what something would look like in reality. Like, you know, are we going to see a major castle? Are we going to see multiple castles? I'd like to think that what we saw in digital form is, barring the fact that people, you know, running around and dancing and singing, that like the physical like nature of the park shown in this video is sort of a representation of what we'll see, but we don't know. But yeah, I mean, I just a couple years ago went to Universal and checked out Harry Potter and checked out the I've suddenly forgotten what's the other big movie?
Fast and Furious.
No, oh my God, come on, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You said other movie, that's a guessing movie.
They do have a Fast and Furious ride, but it's not like an actual part of the park for sure. There's like Simpsons as well, I know. There's like a Simpsons part of the park.
Transformers, there's a bunch of stuff out there. So
it's the one that they're making the sequel to. That was like the biggest grossing. Avatar.
Avatar, oh, right. Yeah. I forgot about that, actually.
I was way off with Fast and Furious, wasn't I?
Yes. But like what's interesting about those two elements of the park is that Harry Potter and Avatar, when you go to those areas, you're in that world. And there's something about, like, especially Avatar, where you to get to go on the – there's a couple rides there, but there's one that's just unbelievable. And it's like a 2 to 3 hour wait to get on that ride. But it's almost worth it because – it is so the area of the park is so gorgeous. They have like the floating rocks and the it's just gorgeous. And like my hope is with the Super Nintendo World, that's what they're going to do. It's going to be a place where just being there, never mind the rides, just being there is going to be stunning.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it is, like, based on like the picture I'm sharing with you guys right now. This is like an actual like an aerial shot of the park while it's in construction. You can see there's like a Yoshi there. There's like the trees are very Mario like. Obviously, with like the mountains and all that stuff too. So it looks like they are basically doing everything that they can basically to have it feel like you are really in that Mario world. But it seems like there are going to be certain things that are going to be like possibly through AR or whatever that they're going to be doing with like the smartphone app and the wristbands and all that stuff. Add in like the, coins and maybe like, the enemies and things like that. So I can certainly see that. I mean, like, it'll be cool to see like on what they do with it. It won't be full on like virtual reality kind of thing, but I think like they're really going to go in with like AR and like what they've done in the past with like, iPhone apps and things like that. So.
Yeah. And like the rides have so much potential. The Avatar ride was, a 4D experience. So it was it was AR headsets with a projection screen on a thing that felt like you were riding the creature in Avatar with wind and moisture and smell.
Kind of like the mom ride in Jordan's Furniture.
Somebody didn't drool me, I hope. Ugh.
Right. Yeah.
No, it's like, but water, you go through. But it's like, it was amazing. And like the potential to do that, and so you look at some of the Harry Potter rides as well. There's so much they're doing now with robotic roller coasters, which are essentially just like a little platform with six seats on it that's attached to a big robot arm, and it can move you around and spin you and stuff. So imagine that, it can mimic faster speeds and going up and down. So then you could suddenly, create something that feels like you're in a kart race. Or, a bunch of other things. So I think they could do some really cool stuff. I just don't know how big they're going to go. Like, Harry Potter's amazing. Avatar's amazing. But frankly, again, if you're not into the experience of being in that world, the rides, there's like almost no rides. They're very slim pickings in terms of rides.
It's just like the experience, I guess, of being there. It's just like with Harry Potter, like, you're basically going through like the world and you see like a dragon, it blows fire. You can actually feel the heat from the fire. So like, mm-hmm. it's a really cool experience in that regard. So
yeah,
it's just really cool that they're doing this with like Nintendo. So Brian, I was kind of curious, like, what's like one, I guess, like either like experience or ride that you want to see most that we don't know about so far from this?
Well, I mean, the one I want to see most, but we do know about, is the Mario Kart, which I think they've confirmed is going to happen.
Yeah.
So that's cool. I haven't actually read much on what it will entail, but my hope is it will be more like a 4D roller coaster and less like go-karts. Because like go-karts, that can't capture the experience. I don't want to be in a go-kart that's got like a theme, driving along a course just – with a map around it. I want to be an experience where I'm spinning around and getting blown up and all that other stuff.
For sure.
The Rainbow Road.
It has to be Rainbow Road, yeah.
Here's my question. Can I throw a spiked turtle shell at my nephew because he's been asking for it?
Right. Well, and that's the thing. Like, yeah, obviously you look at like what they've done in Disney, they've been doing for a long time where they've sort of gamified some of their rides. There's definitely the possibility, maybe not a blue shell, but like, they could add little guns that shoot, turtle shells or things like that to your cart. So there's definitely a lot of possibility with all the sort of mixed reality rides that are being created.
Oh, man, I can only imagine like a family tries that out. All of a sudden they're screaming as they walk out of the park. How dare you? You're trying to kill me. What's wrong with you?
Right.
Just like the game. Perfect.
Exactly. And some smaller stories I want to quickly go through here as well. There's Awesome Games Done Quick, which had their like event just now. They broke their record of $3.13 million raised for the Prevent Cancer Foundation, which they're also celebrating their 10th anniversary that year too, this year in 2020. But it's just like amazing like to see that with Games Done Quick and like what they've done like all these this past like decade basically. you know, bringing in basically $25 million for charity over like this last decade. It's just unreal, honestly.
It's been incredible. And, you know, this year's event was a lot of fun. They had a mixture of different speed runs that they did. I was a big fan of the Battletoads one, obviously, because, you know.
Of course.
But, I mean, every year they do this. And, you know, this summer they're going to try to shoot for that goal again. And I wish them all the best of luck. And obviously people will have suggestions for games to continue speed running. You know, I'm watching these guys play Super Mario Maker 2, and I'm like, I couldn't even get through the tutorial, much less the whatever they're doing here. So, yeah, good luck, guys. I'm definitely going to watch to see if I can learn something.
Yeah. I don't know if you got to watch it at all, Brian.
You know, I didn't. I'm a big fan of the idea, but for some reason, I'm always busy, and I always either forget or just can't catch the stream, which I know is ridiculous because they do it for a while. But yeah, one of these days, I'm going to watch more than sort of the excerpts that people post on Twitter or on websites.
Yeah, the YouTube clips are good for that, honestly, too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. And next story we wanted to touch on here, too, is Limited Run Games. They're coming out with Streets of Rage 4, a physical version of it, which is really exciting. And so, Robert, I imagine that they have to come out with, like, a Genesis-style case for this, right?
You know what? I mean, that's how Sega did it with Sonic Mania. But, yeah, I mean, they usually do games for PlayStation 4 and Nintendo Switch. Whatever the case, they're probably going to have, like, a regular edition, then they'll have a limited edition with a possible Yuzo Koshiro soundtrack or maybe an Atom action figure, you know, just... I'm all over this. And, you know, if they announce a Windjammers 2 one, you're probably all over that. You're probably going to get, like, the wristbands and everything.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, if they got, like an action figure or, like, a statue maybe of, like, Adam and Cherry together or something, oh, yeah. I'd be all about that, honestly.
Just give me Blaze. Give me Blaze. I'm good. But, yeah. We'll probably learn more about at next month at PAX East because they'll be there in spades.
Or PAX South, isn't that? That's coming this right
weekend.
Around the corner.
Yep, this weekend. Right. They'll be there, too. So, and... our buddy Jeremy started working for them, who was on the show previously.
Jeremy Parrish, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So he's working with them now, too. And so, yeah, I mean, if you guys are going to either event, go say hi to Jeremy, and then go, like, where is my Streets of Rage 4 physical? And,
right. another story that we want to touch on here is there's, like, a fan who's basically working on a project basically making Super Mario Brothers reimagined as in a Television 2 title, which is pretty cool. So there was, like, a video that we, you know, that we're going to have in our show notes here. But Robert, you know, I know that this is like something that you brought to my attention, actually. So what was your thought when you first saw this in action?
It's just so impressive how close it is to the 8-bit. Because you have to understand, the Intellivision has, you know, lesser technology than an 8-bit NES. So being able to go in there and make something just as cohesive and playable as the classic Super Mario Brothers, I mean, it's a feat. And it is just one level. Obviously, you know, well, one and a half. But he doesn't run through the whole game. But... it's great work, nevertheless, and it just goes to show that, you know, I mean, granted, Nintendo will never allow an actual release, but it's a great little project that, you know, this guy is able to get the hang of an Intellivision tech. I mean, it's really cool. I'd like to see him bring it to shows sometime so we could play it and just see if it actually plays pretty well with that disc controller. I don't know.
And I think the original Mario Brothers, not Super Mario Brothers, but the original Mario Brothers came out for Atari 2600 as well.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And if I recall, that was it, the characters looked weird in them. Well, they look.
Was that 2600 or was it a later model?
Maybe 5200.
I forget which one.
Yeah. But yeah, so like it's really cool to see that. And like I always love kind of like seeing these like demakes basically of games. You know, it's kind of like see like how they look. And this guy looks like he's doing an awesome job so far in it. So we'll see like how far it gets before Nintendo puts like the kibosh on it.
Yeah, and you were right. It did come out for 2600. And I was
really?
Right. Characters look dinky. Yeah, I just did a look up on Google and it looks pretty close, actually.
It wasn't aesthetically pleasing back then, I remember.
Yeah.
So wait, I'm just astounded. That's so weird. That in my mind, the idea of a Nintendo game on an Atari platform, especially that Atari platform that's so iconic and ugly, is crazy.
Well, there was that and Donkey Kong, and I think Donkey Kong Jr. was also an Atari.
Oh, yeah.
Donkey Kong looked more like Chewbacca meets the Cookie Monster. He didn't look like
Dinky Kong in that case. Yeah,
Dinky Kong, exactly. He didn't look like Donkey Kong at all.
Yeah, and I actually remember the Donkey Kong on there, and like for some reason, I don't know, Donkey Kong, because it was in arcades, because it was like on PC, it didn't strike me as that strange. But like Mario has always been, you know, Mario's not, I know that there are some versions that have gone into arcades, but it wasn't really an arcade game. So it's so weird to think of it off of an NES, you know?
Yeah. I hear that.
For sure, yeah. And last story that we want to touch on here, this came from Twitter, where Gary Whitta, who is most well-known for being like the writer for Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, responded to like a post here from God of War's art director, Raf Grassetti, when he posted up like some like original artwork of like basically Star Fox, basically the Star Fox characters. And he's done this before, like in the past with like Pokemon, like various other franchises and stuff within Nintendo. And he does like an amazing job. But Gary Whitta responded saying, "I want to write this animated movie." And so Raf like responded with a "Let's do a GIF," basically.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it's in Nintendo's court there, but there are two things here. I mean, number one, you know, Raf did a great job despite the fact that Slippy still looks kind of freaky.
We can't help that.
And number two, you know, the idea of bringing Nintendo-based movies, you know, it isn't so far-fetched anymore. This isn't the 90s, and we don't have Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo starring in a movie. They're actually working with Illumination Entertainment, I believe, on a Mario film, which is supposed to come out in a couple of years or so here. So, I mean, the idea of Nintendo licensing out its works to create inspired movies is not a bad idea. And, you know, making like a CG film or an animated film would be a great idea. Live action, it'd be a little weird because they'd look like furries.
A little weird?
Just a tad.
Like, you raise a good point. Like, obviously, Nintendo's super into the idea of getting into movies. Shigeru Miyamoto's working on that Mario movie that's coming.
Right, the animated movie, yeah.
Yeah, I think 100% of what happens next will be based on how well that's received. But Shigeru Miyamoto's been interested in trying to get the properties into theaters for like a decade. So I think if it does even kind of okay, I could absolutely see them pursuing other movies. And why not Star Fox?
I mean, you mean like the Bob Hoskins movie didn't do that already?
Come on. While we're at it, can we get a Metroid movie and get Brie Larson or Jennifer Lawrence in there? Let's do that.
I'd be down for that, honestly. Yeah. Jennifer Lawrence, I think, would be a good choice for sure.
There you go.
Yeah, but we'll wait and see, like, if anything, like, I don't think anything necessarily will come from this, but maybe this will spark the idea sometime down the road, like, within the next decade. We'll see.
Wishful thinking, we'll see.
Welcome!
And that's going to lead us now to the part of the show called What Are You Playing? We get to the games we've all been playing or have recently beat. So, Brian, with you being our special guest, why don't you tell us what you've been playing?
I finally finished, and I put that in air quotes, Control, Remedy's Control, yeah. Which is such a superb game. I had gotten stuck on it because the game, if you haven't played it, it allows you to sort of take your own approach. And what I didn't realize is that means it also allows you to try to get to the end without nearly the abilities you need. And so I discovered that I actually hadn't unlocked one of the chief, like, you know, an ability that's tied to a button that I just hadn't unlocked yet. And so I kept running into this wall, and finally I went back and went through a couple other missions and then finally beat it. I still want to go back and do a lot more of the side missions I haven't touched yet, but such a fantastic game. Also, I've been playing a lot of auto chess, different auto duelers, however you want to call them, suddenly forgot, Teamfight Tactics, and I've forgotten what the Dota 2 one is called.
Underlords? Okay.
Oh, Underlords. Thank you.
Yeah, you're right.
Might and Magic is getting one. And so I decided to go freshen up my skills on Underlords. So I have a better sense of like the two types that are out there and kind of looking forward to that. And of course, I've been playing a lot of iPhone games. The Cards of Darkness is my current favorite, which is a fantastic game if you haven't played it yet. But yeah, that's basically what I've been playing.
Very cool. Very cool. Robert.
Still playing my way through Oddworld Stranger's Wrath. Still can't talk about it yet because its embargo isn't up yet, but I'll talk about it soon. But I do want to talk about this one great game I've been playing from the team at Vertex Pop called Super Crush KO. This is a stylish little brawler where you can punch, shoot, and juggle waves of deadly robots as you attempt to save your precious kitty from an evil alien lady. That's literally how the story goes. But, I mean, this game's got a great art style, fun soundtrack, and it's challenging. You know, trying to put together all these combos and everything and staying alive while everybody comes at you with attacks is pretty wild. So I've been really enjoying the heck out of that, and I highly recommend it if you're in the mood for a beat-em-up. That's really cool. I've also been delving back into my PlayStation Vita to kind of prepare for today's handheld episodes. I'll talk about one of the games I was playing in Subscura in a little bit, but I've also been getting into, like, some of the older PlayStation games. You know, Darkstalkers was really fun to play again, even with the Vita's controls. Borderlands 2 on Vita, which is underappreciated. It's such a, it's not an amazing port, but it's a good port. Like, they crammed the entire game into this little handheld system. It's really nice.
Wow.
And, you know, Super Hydora, which is a really great Gradius style shooter from the team that did Cursed Castilla. And yeah, I mean, I've just been playing a variety of stuff, but just getting ready for March and April, because, man, we're going to be busy.
Oh, yeah.
But what are you playing there, David?
Sure. So not too different from like the previous few episodes. So Civilization VI on Switch is one I've been playing a lot of lately. I really love playing as France in that, actually, because they have like a focus on building wonders and spy units. So I figured that that's kind of like the way that I like to play pretty much. So yeah, been enjoying that. Like it seems like to run really well for the most part, but every so often, like if you're playing for an extended period of time, because of Civilization, that's what you have to do with that game. It will sometimes crash, you know, just because like the Switch just can't handle like when you get into like the later like time periods, and like, you know, you have like enemies that have like so many units on the map at one point, and then it's just too much for the system to handle at that point. But otherwise it runs very well for the most part, just for those, like, you know, for the off chance, like whenever it does crash. There's also Hollow Knight, which I'm playing through for the first time right now and just absolutely loving that. Definitely one of the best Metroidvania games I played in like more modern history for sure. And yeah, just, you know, just enjoying that. Like really, like the challenge with that game is just kind of figuring out like where I gotta go next and what I might be missing. So I end up like revisiting parts of the map like over and over just to make sure I'm not missing anything. And also just to try to like get like the story moving along, basically. So there's that. And also still playing through Manhunt, actually. So I'm playing the PS2 game Manhunt on my PS4. You know, it's a nice little kind of palate cleanse, I guess, from like the more kind of cutesy games I've been playing lately. And you know, it's just kind of funny, like going back to that game again, and you know, considering like how you know how much you know there's like a lot of controversy like around it when that first came out, and playing it now, and like seeing like how, I guess, like tame it is compared to like, you know, today's visuals and all that stuff. So it's just kind of funny going back to that. But yeah, there is a game code here I have for giveaway, which is a PlayStation Vita code. And I know, Robert, you have a Vita code to give away later on as well. Mine is for Nightcry. So the horror game that received the heart and soul of the Clock Tower series, Nightcry is a terrifying adventure set upon a luxurious passenger ship with no escape. As the evening's festivities reach their peak, a grisly murder turns everything upside down as the passengers descend into horror and paranoia, distrusting and accusing one another of the killing. As night falls and the cry echoes out through the ship, the true nightmare begins. So if you played the Clock Tower games at all, you'll basically know what you're in for. So if that sounds like your jam, definitely jump on this. Again, this is a PlayStation Vita code. The code is 8EBEB8N7HJ29. Again, that's Nightcry on PlayStation Vita. Enjoy, and if you do redeem that, definitely let us know at ARC Podcast on Twitter.
Welcome back to the Stage of History.
And with that, we have the Stage of History, which is a celebration of retro titles that deserve a spot, for better or for worse, in the pantheons of history. So I figure since we are talking about handheld games, we'll talk about a handheld game that I don't think a lot of people really know about or have played at all, but still popular nonetheless, which is Sonic the Hedgehog Pocket Adventure for Neo Geo Pocket Color. So this is a 1999 platformer by SNK. It is based on the 1992 title Sonic the Hedgehog 2, borrowing much of the stage themes and gameplay elements. This marked the first time Sega was directly involved in the development of a Sonic game for a non-Sega platform, and several members of the SNK development team later formed Dimps, which went on to develop several more Sonic games for handheld devices. So I imagine, like, you know, again, like this being like the first time that Sega basically developed a Sonic game like outside of like their, you know, their own platforms, that this probably gave them like the confidence actually to become like a third party developer, you know, with like Dreamcast and all. Because like if you think about it, like this came out in 1999, specifically December 1999. So this is after the Dreamcast came out. But also, I think they already knew that the PlayStation 2 was going to be like a big problem for them. So I guess in a way, this was like a little bit, it kind of gave them like, I guess, like a little bit of an out or like a plan B, I guess, you know, for the inevitable that would happen. So.
Not to mention the fact that, you know, it gave Sonic the footing he needed to become a multi-platform hero. It would take obviously several years to see him on Nintendo platforms and everything, but when he arrived, it was a big deal. And then we started getting stuff like Mario and Sonic at the Olympic Games, and then we started seeing Sega's other franchises to make the jumps here. So this was a significant title, not only to Sega's progress into third-party publishing, but also to Sonic himself, who is still an iconic character. I mean, his movie comes out next month, you know, and we'll probably get a new game or probably a Sonic Adventure remaster announced sometime this year. So, I mean, he's still relevant today. I mean, it's just really cool how games like this from the past can still stand out in today's market and still remind us what a great hero he is. I mean, never mind the design with fingers and teeth. We're just going to forget that existed. But you get my point. I mean, it's this, and also on top of that, this is one of the Neo Geo Pocket Color's one of its best games. It's been critically acclaimed across the board. I thought it was a blast. Really great to play. It had a lot of the gameplay elements I remember from the Sonic days. In fact, I can't think of anything really deterred too much from it. So yeah, I mean, I absolutely think this is a significant title. And I can't help but think, you know, a re-release maybe, you know, somewhere down the road to kind of remind us of how great this game was wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. But the question is, who would release it, SNK or Sega?
Yeah, I mean, if there was like a Neo Geo Pocket Color collection and you like add this along with like SNK versus Capcom, Match of the Millennium and like other games like that, I mean, I think that'd be really cool, honestly.
Totally.
It'd be great to see it in a sort of, you know, one of the things we're starting to see are a lot of these collections put into a standalone handheld. I would love to see one for the Neo Geo Pocket Neo Geo, because you know, right now what we're seeing are typically platform games, old platform games put into a handheld, which is fine, but like there are a lot of people who never experienced the Pocket Neo Geo and a bunch of other systems out there, so that would be super cool.
Yeah, and I know there's like still some love for the Neo Geo Pocket Color today, because I forget like the name of it, but like there was a fighting game that came out not too long ago that basically uses the same style as like the Neo Geo Pocket Color.
I think you're talking about. I know which one. Pocket Rumble, I think it was, for Switch.
I believe so. Yeah, it was like an indie game, I know, and like uses the exact same like art style basically as like those games. So, yeah.
So it was Pocket Rumble.
That's going to lead us now to Obscura.
And for Obscura, it's funny because I'm also bringing up another Sega game that kind of stood out from its previous endeavors here, and that is Afterburner Black Falcon. This was a game that came out for the PlayStation Portable in March 2007. It featured the same sort of like arcade hook as the previous Afterburner games. You fly a jet and you're taking on enemies both on the ground and in the air. But there are some differences here. First off, the game was developed by Planet Moon Studios, who previously worked on Armed and Dangerous for Xbox and PC, as well as Giant Citizen Kabuto, excuse me. And so they added their own distinct touches. Like, for instance, missiles were different. You could fire some at airborne enemies and fire some at ground enemies. You could actually use two different buttons to deter the difference between the two. And then on top of that, you could pick up power-ups as you went along with these little parachuted boxes that came your way. And there were also three different storylines to choose from, each with plot twists and each with their different sort of vehicles. Are in aerial craft, I mean, rather. Why do I say vehicles?
I guess they're vehicles in a way, yeah.
Well, aerial vehicles, sure. And then on top of that, you can unlock a number of paint jobs for each of the jets. And along with the single-player campaign, there were also numerous multiplayer challenges with 8-player competitive and 2-player co-op, which I believe is the first for the Afterburner series. Unfortunately, it didn't sell incredibly well, so that was kind of like until like Afterburner Climax came out for Xbox 360, PS3, and mobile, that would be the last we see of the series. But it, you know, a lot of people thought it was a pretty good game. I enjoyed it. I don't know if either of you guys have played it, but this is just, to me, a nice little standout in the PSP library and one of those games that, you know, Sega and Planet Moon tried to do something different with the franchise, and I think it kind of paid off.
I mean, I never played it myself, but I do always love the Afterburner games, you know? So, I mean, like, this definitely looks like something that would be, like, worth, like, looking back on, like, especially if it's still on the PlayStation Vita eShop right now, so.
It's not, actually. It got delisted, like, years ago, but you can find a physical copy at the very least, and it's not too expensive, so. Brian, you ever hear of this one?
No, I mean, obviously, I heard of the franchise, but yeah, I've never heard of this particular game, and I definitely didn't play it, obviously. But yeah, it sounds like something worth checking out if I can find it.
Yeah. I think if you find like a used game store, I'm sure someone's got to have it out there somewhere. I'm enjoying my digital copy, so I'm good with it, because I bought it when it was out, and I was like, yep, I'm never going to rip it. It's kind of funny how we just brought up Sega and the two shots there. That's great.
Yeah, exactly.
Gamecom.
Active.
And that's going to lead us now to our main topic, which is looking through the history of handheld consoles. So, obviously, like, we can't really talk about handheld consoles without mentioning Nintendo, since Nintendo seems to have had, like, a stranglehold in this market for, like, such a long while. So, I guess we'll first touch upon, like, on why Nintendo has ruled the market for so long. And, Brian, like, since I know that you're, like, you know, such a big, like, fan and aficionado, really, of, like, handheld consoles, I was kind of curious if you can kind of give, like, your take on why Nintendo ruled so long in this market.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they really just know how to approach these systems as toys. And like, that's a thing. They have this sort of playfulness in the way that they've created these systems over the years that have made them feel like something fun to hold on to and mess around with. And like, in my mind, I love a lot of the Nintendo systems. My favorite of all time is the Micro. And I think that system is such a perfect example of that. You know, it's gotten to the point, you know, its screen is like a postage stamp, but it's like this vibrant color. It's such a fun little design. You know, you could slip it into your pocket and it plays these amazing games. And it's just, you know, their design is just so smart. And, you know, they get credit for doing a lot of things that sort of shaped the way people interact with games, like the direction pad. So I think that that's a big part of it. They, you know, and obviously they sort of, they didn't really create the market, but they popularized the market. And so you go back to the Game & Watch, which by no means is the first series of games, you know, portable games that came out. It's actually kind of late in the game. Well, 4 years past when they started hitting. But still,
well,
very
popular. I know there was the Microvision that came out, I think, like, around the same year, or, like, I think, like, maybe a year before the Game & Watch.
Right, the year before.
Yeah, and don't forget the Coleco handhelds. You know, those little stand-up arcade games. Those are kind of portable, too. So.
Yeah, so the first, I'll try not to do this too often, but I always like to tell this story because I'm fascinated by it.
Sure, yeah.
So the very first handheld electronic, fully electronic game, so not something like a Periscope, which is a sort of a game that combined electromechanical with, I guess you could say, digital. It didn't have a digital screen, though. But the first pure digital game to ever come out that was a handheld was this game called Auto Race. And the story, my understanding, and I've never personally researched this, or I've researched it, but I've never personally talked to the people involved. And it sounds like one of those crazy stories that maybe isn't entirely true. But supposedly what happened was this company was basically awash in displays for calculators, and someone in their office was trying to figure out what to do with them. And this guy was like, I have this idea. I can use these LED displays to kind of create a really basic game.
It's like MacGyver it, basically.
Right, yeah, totally. And so he came up with this first game, which was called Auto Race, which is essentially, it's this – it's a very simple game. It's a drag racing game where you just have to kind of shift gears and go from the bottom of the display to the top. And there are little red lights that show your movement that light up. And it did fairly well. And so that was in 76. And then in 77, he came out with Football. Hmm. At that point... I think the Auto Race, if memory serves, I believe that was pre-Mattel. I think it was like a company that was working with Mattel. Mm-hmm. Right. But then Mattel got into the football, and obviously it blew up big time. This is 77, and then they came out with this whole slew of soccer and baseball and basketball.
Yeah. They basically formed they basically formed their own Mattel Electronics division in 78, I think it was, because it blew up so much and they wanted such demand on these games. And they were these big VHS tapes styled, you know, these weren't little dinky Game Boys.
They were so great though.
Yeah,
man. I remember, I'm not someone into sports. I've never been into sports. I played some sports, but I've never loved or enjoyed watching sports. But man, Mattel Football, I used to play that game so much. That was such a fun game to play. And it was like, it was, you know, really basic technology, but they made the most of it. It was such a fantastic game. I don't know what got me off on that tangent. I guess just the fact that, like, the origins are these calculators that were sort of modified into games. And, you know, by the 80s, when you had, I think Ball was the first, which is a fantastic name for a
Ball,
game.
Yeah.
it was the first Game & Watch game. And, you know, suddenly everybody started making them. So Bandai was making them. I think Tommy was making them. And yeah, then it kind of blew up into all these different directions. And you got, you know, it wasn't until, what, 89 that you had the return of the cartridge-based, if you could call Microvision a cartridge-based system. But
it was, yeah, because you can, like, because I know, like, for the Microvision anyway, you can actually switch out the games that way through cartridges. Yeah. So yeah,
you could, but the funny thing is, I don't know if you have ever seen a Microvision or have one, but it's not it's literally, it replaces like half the machine.
Yeah, basically. Like, yeah
the screen, like, you replace the top of the screen and it has the cartridge built. It's just this weird I mean, I love it, but it's such a weird system.
For sure There's nothing else quite like it. But, like, yeah, as far as, like, switching out cartridges, quote unquote, I mean, it does do that, but in a very, like, I don't know, crude kind of way, I guess.
Yeah. See, I think where the Microvision failed is that, you know, as cool as the concept was, it just didn't have, like, the catchy library that the Game Boy had when it came out. Like, Nintendo introduced Tetris, brilliant, you know. Yeah. And we'll get to more Tetris a little later. We have a little announcement to talk about, but the Tetris came along alongside the Game Boy, and it sold nearly like 1-to-1, if I recall correctly. Like, everybody wanted to play Tetris. Like, this was a system with a lime green screen with no light, and they were doing everything in their power to keep the screen lit so mm-hmm. they could beat this next level of Tetris, you know. And obviously, it has fair share of other games. Super Mario Land, of course. I have to give a shout out to Revenge of the Gator.
Of course.
Just a great launch lineup, and for years that support continued. Some of the games were a little gimmicky, but for the most part, a lot of great games to play on the go. Nintendo knew how to tap that market, and as a result, the Game Boy became an imminent success, leading to mm-hmm. its other systems over the years.
I mean, the Game Boy became, like, such a huge hit. It was, like, the first game console I can recall where you had, like, grandmothers playing it, basically. Exactly. Because of Tetris. You know, it became, like, the Tetris machine for, like, a lot of people. Right. Even Hillary Clinton, there's, like, a picture of her, like, on an airplane playing Tetris on the Game Boy, and it's, like, such an iconic picture, but it's there, and it's just kind of, like, amazing to see, you know? So.
Well, and it's funny, because, like, that's what Nintendo does. Like, Duck Hunt and NES, that was a pack-in for a lot of people, but, like, that was the game for the NES when it came out. Mm-hmm. And then you had Tetris, and you had Game Boy, and then the Wii, you had Wii Sports, obviously another build-in. But, like, there were people who bought that system and never got another game. Like, that was that's all they needed.
Wii Sports. The whole idea of, like, a pack-in game that, like, really kind of, like, you know, defined, like, that console for, like, a lot of people. Like, Nintendo were, like, the masters of doing that. And they mm-hmm. just had, like, the right software, really, to pair up with whatever hardware that they came out with. And that just sold like gangbusters for them, no matter how they did it, but for, like, a lot of cases, for sure, you know, with, like, Wii and, like, you know, with the Game Boy and all that stuff. So, yeah.
But I'll tell you one thing I liked is that the Game Boy sparred some good competition for the time, because about a year or two later, we had two big competitors, both of which wanted to incorporate color in their consoles. I mean, we had the Sega Game Gear, which came out in 1991 in North America and Europe. But then we had also the underappreciated Turbo Express. Now, what was cool about the Turbo Express is it played the same TurboGrafx-16 hue cards as the TurboGrafx-16. Now, it was expensive. It was like $300 compared to like the Game Boy's 100-something.
It looked like a walkie-talkie, too, honestly.
It did, but it was cool for its time because, you know, the screen actually looked really good. It was able to display 64 sprites at once, 512 different colors, and it had a really great quality screen. And I believe it had a TV adapter, too. So if you wanted to take it on, it was a big deal well before cell phones. So
it did what Nintendo don't, basically. Yeah.
Pretty much.
And I have to say, somewhere out there, some former Epics or Atari person is crying because you didn't mention the Atari Lynx.
Well, mm-hmm. that didn't come out until a little bit later. I was going to get to that. But, I mean, it's just a matter of there were a bunch of different, like, inspired systems, the Atari Lynx among them. Sorry I did not mention that. It does have a pretty inspired library with Kung Fu and all that. But it also had some good arcade ports, too. I remember playing Hydra on it.
And I remember, like, the Game Gear, I got that right after graduating. So I was a police reporter for like 15, 20 years. And early on, this is a terrible thing to admit, but I got a Game Gear because there were a lot of times where I'd have to go to crime scenes and just wait. And so I got a Game Gear and I got the little TV adapter. They had a color TV adapter.
Yeah, the TV mm-hmm. tuner. Yeah.
Yes.
And I would sit in my car at a crime scene and watch TV or play Sonic on my Game Gear.
And since you're a part of, like, the police department, it kind of looks like you're doing your job in a sense, too, with, like, the antennas coming out and everything, you know?
Oh, no. So I was working for newspapers.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
But, yeah. So, yeah, I shouldn't admit that. But it was, like, you know, tedious. And it was great having, like, the idea that you could have this great – because Game Gear had such a great library. I love that system. Mm-hmm. Of course, it went through batteries. Remember, it used AA batteries.
Oh, yeah. If you think that was
like through
batteries?
4,000 AA batteries.
I yeah.
So you think that was bad? The system that followed after, the Sega Nomad, went through 6 batteries in 3 hours.
Mm. Oh, man. It was terrible. Yeah. So you would – yeah, I would – and then they had that – I know obviously the Game Boy had it too, but they had like a magnifier you could buy for the Game Gear. That would, like, basically was just a big magnifying glass that you could slap on it to make the screen bigger. Man, those are the days. Yeah, I have 30-something, probably closer to 40 handhelds collection.
Nice.
But I'm missing, like, I don't have the Lynx, the Turbo Express, or the Nomad. Mm. I'm missing some pretty biggies, but or the Neo Geo Pocket Color. That's it's an expensive system.
It's hard to find, honestly. I tried finding one not too long ago, and they are hard to find, and they're expensive, like whoever you try to buy it off of. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. They can get it really expensive there. Ironically, like, one of the few handhelds I own is the Sega Nomad, and I won't game anywhere without it unless I have the AC cable, because I don't want to drain 6 batteries in 3 hours.
Yeah.
But I was impressed by, like, all the Genesis games that ran like a charm, and its control setup was kind of cute, too. The D-pad actually felt pretty good on this thing compared to, like, struggling with other handhelds. So.
I remember the very first time I played the Sega Nomad, actually, was at Epcot Center, I remember. And because, like, they had, like, this whole, like, area, like, devoted to, like, the world of tomorrow. And, like, here's, like, cool tech that, you know, that's got to be coming out soon. I think, like, Nomad didn't come out yet. It was about to come out, but they had, like, an early copy of it, basically. Early copies and set up kiosks and all that stuff for it. So I remember playing it there. It's just like, oh, cool! I can play Comic Zone like right here, like on the, like on like a handheld console. And I liked that game back then. It was just kind of cool to have like a handheld play it on there. But I never actually like owned one. But it was actually funny because like the first handheld console I personally owned was a Game Gear. My neighbor had the Game Boy, and we played the Game Boy a lot for sure. But the Game Gear was like my console, and I remember like going over to my godparents' house and like me, you know, and having like my goddaughter, like, you know, who would become my future goddaughter, playing my Game Gear basically, and like. I don't know. I think, like, with me being, like, a young boy and everything, just trying to, like, keep an eye on her. It's like, you better not be damaging my stuff, whatever, and all this stuff. So, you know, but it was a lot of fun for sure. Like, I remember having the Jurassic Park, and, like, there was, like, an NBA game I had on there, and, like, it was a lot of fun. It was really cool.
Yeah, but then we also have the flip side, and, like, you know, the handhelds that didn't really do for the market what they were intending to do, and I have to bring this up, GameCom. This is
GameCom.
Tiger Electronics attempts to do like a cartridge based system, and I remember like they were going ambitious with the library. They had like Resident Evil 2, they had Duke Nukem, they had all these games,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they were on a really cruddy screen.
Yeah, it was a weird year. I actually have a GameCom, and a couple other weird ones that came out. Like the 90s, in many ways, despite the fact that there were some duds, I feel like that was sort of the 80s and 90s were like the golden age of portables. Because there were so many companies, you know, Neo Geo, you had the GameCom, you had the Nomad, the Supervision, the Watara Supervision.
Oh, the Watara.
That was an interesting handheld too.
And the Gamut or Gamate, I don't know how you pronounce it.
Bitcorp Gamate.
Yeah.
But like all these companies were testing the waters, and like it seemed like they saw the success of those little LCD single game systems and were like, oh, you know, Game Boy, that Nintendo did real well with that. And then they went to Game Boy and now they're doing great. So we could do the same thing. And then they all like failed miserably.
Yeah, almost all. And that kind of continued into the 2000s too. I'll get to the ones that we are very most notable about there, but I have to bring up two in particular that failed pretty badly in the 2000s. The first one is obviously the Gizmodo.
I have a Gizmodo.
I remember going to a press event for the Gizmodo and it sounded really impressive and all that, and then nothing, you know, when they launched it, like poop, that's it, just poop.
Yeah.
I don't actually know if the Gizmondo. I don't know if it actually, I guess it came out, but it was, I think it like, I think it was like a week, a month. I mean, it, honestly, it
didn't
failed.
Last long at all.
Yeah,
it
I know.
Essentially it failed before it hit the market. I think it was like it was shipping, but they knew it was failed.
Either that or there was something, I believe there was like a downfall of a company that was involved as well, Tiger Telematics or something.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so it was that tied into it as well. So
are they like related at all to Tiger Electronics, or is it like completely separate?
It's completely separate. And I'm sorry for calling it Gizmodo. I mean, I'm so used to whatever that was.
The website.
Yeah, I mean, either way, it's not a good name, so yeah.
Yeah. Oh, if you think that name sticks in your throat, then how about the N-Gauge from
the
Nokia?
The N-Gauge. Yes. So I have a little bit of a story with the N-Gauge, actually.
Yeah,
So whenever I'll go visit Ireland, there was, let's see, my Uncle Paul basically ran a cell phone shop over there. And I remember the very first time I saw or even played an N-Gauge, he had it. He had it like right there in his shop. So he asked me, since he knew I was a gamer and everything, it's like, oh, is this something that my kids would like and all that stuff? And it's just like, oh, cool. Like, because I just remember like just hearing about it in like magazines and stuff like that, but I never actually like saw it or anything. So I was just like, oh, so this is the N-Gauge. So I was like holding it. I was just like, wow, this is weird. This is like, it's trying to be a phone. It's trying to be a game console and doesn't quite do either well. I played Duke Nukem on it or something. And it was just like, it was just really weird. You know?
I remember trying to play a Sonic game on it. Emphasis on trying. Like,
yeah.
We talk about how,
well, it was.
I don't know. Go ahead, Brian.
No, I was going to say it was a vertical screen. That was the biggest problem. Well, it had a lot of problems, but like it was taller than it was wide. It was a small screen. It's funny, they actually had, and I can't remember, it might have been Brothers in Arms. There was a strategy turn-based game that came out on it that was actually quite good. It was that's what they should have stuck to, because anything fast-paced, you just couldn't really play on that. And Sega was like a good example of that. It was just the screen was too small. It was too narrow.
Yeah. Did you feel like that strategy game was like kind of more built for the console? Is that why?
Yeah, I mean, it was. A turn-based, so you could kind of take your time with it. You weren't sort of rushing through the game. But I, what I love is that the first one was so terrible. and they thought, well, let's fix some of the problems and release the QD, the second version.
Right.
Which was like, okay, this is a better phone, but it's still a terrible gaming system.
I found the name of the game you're talking about, Pathway to Glory, right?
Yes, was that Brothers in Arms, or what was that?
It was something like, it was a tactical turn-based game with a military theme.
Okay,
it took place in the summer of 43, yeah. So it was probably same era as Brother in Arms.
Right, right. Yeah, it was a pretty decent game. But yeah, that was a terrible system. And yeah, it was funny because like I think the timing of that was, let's see, that was 2003.
Yeah.
So we're starting to get into the era of
Game Boy Advance
at that point. Yeah, so Game Boy, so it's going up against some incredibly tough competition, which is the funny thing. Like, I guess it would have been bad either way, but like, that's what you put up against what is, you know, the Game Boy Advance SP was amazing.
Yep.
And like, what a terrible system to try to, you know, go up against.
Well, the rewind a bit there, too. I mean, there was like the Neo Geo Pocket and the Neo Geo Pocket Color,
yep.
You know, which came out, I think, 1999 or like early 2000s, basically. It's like around that time. Again, I never personally owned one, but my neighbor did. So I played it on his. I remember borrowing it, too, for like a long while, because like I was just obsessed with SNK versus Capcom on there. And there was like a lot of like really cool games on there. Like it didn't have like a great library or anything, like a great as in big library. But, you know, like the quality of titles there were pretty high, I feel like. And I feel like, you know, if this actually had some more third-party support, just more like, I guess, just kind of like backing behind it, maybe better marketing or something like that to it, I feel like this could have actually competed with Nintendo pretty well, at least kind of hanging in there, kind of like another Sega in a sense, you know?
Yeah, you know, the title that stuck out for me on that was Samurai Showdown 2, and what's good is that that game's coming back next month when Samurai Showdown launches for Nintendo Switch. Because it's going to be a bonus game. So people will
To
experience
that cool.
Neo Geo Pocket Color game on the Switch, at least. But I'm telling you, we need a collection.
So we need more Pocket Color games. Just come out in some way. Just bring out a collection. I'm all for it. I'll buy it. I'll buy two of them.
Three, please. Yeah.
So I got to mention a couple of games. I want to go back to the Gizmondo, but a couple of systems that came out around the same time that were either, I don't know if I'd call them failures. I mean, they were failures, but they're really, really different. The Gizmondo, the Cybico. I don't know if either of you have ever heard of the Cybico.
I've heard a little bit about it, yeah.
Yeah,
and then the Tapwave.
Tapwave I had not heard of, actually.
Tapwave Zodiac. So the Cybico was a Russian handheld, they called it a computer, but it was like, it looked like those machines you use to, like, print out labels.
I'm looking at a picture of it now. Yeah, it kind of looks like a Texas Instruments kind of thing.
Can you imagine playing, trying to play Duke Nukem on that thing?
So it has a full keyboard. It has buttons all over the place. It is like, it is insane. So I have one of these, and I haven't actually tried to play any games on it, mostly because it used radio, I think, to deliver a lot of. I don't know if I can get a game on it, is basically what I'm saying. But I mentioned it on Twitter, and there were a bunch of people who were like, I had one of those. But the funny thing is, the other half of those statements were always like, you know, my dad, my mom, my whoever got it for me because they thought it was a gaming system, and it was awful. So it was like the, you know, the knockoff Game Boy that a bunch of people got that, you know, they weren't very happy with.
Wow.
So the Gizmondo, I just wanted to mention the Gizmondo because I have one because they sent me one before it came out, and it came with some games that never came out. One of them was this game called Colors, which I think it was called Colors. I think of Colors because of the movie, the mm-hmm. gang movie.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it was a gang game, and the idea was – the thing about the Gizmondo was that it had a camera on the back, and the idea was you could actually play augmented reality games. In theory. So keep in mind, this is 2005. So that's crazy. 15 years ago, there was this company that was making a system that had a camera built into it so you could play augmented reality games. It also had a phone built into it for not for talking, but so you could use GPS and internet capabilities. So it was like super ahead of its time. But this Colors game, the idea was you would physically point it at buildings in the city you lived in, and you would tag those buildings with your tag, and you could take over your real city. And then if you traveled somewhere, you could do that in that city. So it's sort of like a gang-flavored Pokemon Go, but instead of – or maybe the predecessor. I've suddenly forgotten the name of the predecessor to Pokemon Go. But like this idea of GPS-connected, like augmented reality game in 2005, which is like crazy. And it was kind of fun. Like I couldn't play with other people because it hadn't come out yet, but the basic mechanics of it were pretty sound. And then the third one that I mentioned, the Zodiac Tapwave, that one actually never did come out. But it's another system that is like way, way ahead of its time. It was this sort of really flat system. It had its massive screen on it, and it ran a Palm operating system. So what it offered you was basically PDA games.
It's a very curvy kind of system, I see.
And with an analog stick, right?
Right. Yeah. It was like, it's a really, even to today's standards, it's like if this came out today with new guts, it would be a pretty good system.
Yeah. Design's not bad, honestly, at least from first glance of it. Yeah.
And it could play movies. It could play music. It has a nice size screen. But the company went bankrupt before they could release it, which is a real bummer. They had this huge rollout where they were going to – or plans for a huge rollout. And it just – it never happened, which is, you know, unfortunate. This tech, like all of these systems, there's something I think redeeming in just about every one of these handhelds. Some of them, yes, like the Zodiac – or I'm sorry, like the Cybico, maybe not a lot of redeeming qualities other than that transparent purple, like Jolly Rancher colored system.
Honestly, it kind of looks like a Texas Instruments calculator, but like marketed for girls, basically.
And like designed by someone who was on heroin at the time. Yeah,
let's see how many buttons I can put on this.
It needs more buttons.
What you don't know is that there are 50 buttons on the back. Probably.
Right. Like I could see that whoever designed this would bring it in, and the person who was in charge would be like, "I like it, but I think it could use more buttons." Yeah. And he's like, "All right, I think I could squeeze some." There's literally buttons in a row across the top of it, which it doesn't even make sense. It's like, all right, you already have a full-size keyboard and like a directional pad and like seven other buttons and then a bunch of the bottom, but you needed five or six more across the top.
It looks like something you'd find in the old animated series Jim with the Rock Band.
Oh, yeah, yeah, oh, right. Yeah.
Looks like something like one of the bad guys would use, trying to like stop
shoot people with it.
Right. But hey, at least this is an original system and not a knockoff, not something that looks like a knockoff like the Game King. This came out in 2004 with like a Game Boy Advance style screen, and suspiciously enough, before the PlayStation Portable came out, it looked like it had a similar build to the PlayStation Portable.
Yes. So there's like a bunch of game systems that came out in China, typically ran games on some sort of removable media, and I don't think I have any of them. I'd love to get my hands on them because I think they're fascinating. But yeah, I think that they're basically knockoffs or something very close to a knockoff, where they're really meant to run pirated games. I think that's basically what these systems do.
Right. Without, I guess, like egregiously saying that, that's what they were for, but that's more or less what they were built for. So
yeah. Right. And there was a game system called the GP2X, which was a Korean game system that was very pirate friendly. It ran emulators for a bunch of systems.
Oh, I know this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a cool looking system, and it looks like it would be like released today, honestly, by like Analog or something like that. But like, yeah, it's very clear what it's used for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But so, and then we get into the 2000s and like the era of like, I don't know, the PSP Go was, I really, really liked that system.
Yeah. I like the original PlayStation Portable, although there is some questioning as to, do I really want a copy of Hackers on PSP? But I'll tell you, it was also a great time for Nintendo because they introduced the Nintendo DS, which was their little twin screen system.
That's huge for
touch
them,
screen ability. I mean, yeah, it did really well for them. I'd like to think like the 2000s really picked up like the handheld game in terms of like use of technology and use of like downloadable digital media. Because like before then, you didn't really have much capability. I mean, I wasn't going to download anything on my, you know, Sabico. So
right.
But I mean, the PlayStation Portable, I personally like. I mean, the PSP Go was cool, but I think a lot of people were annoyed by it because it was one of those early digital only systems. You couldn't use physical media on it.
Yeah, it's such a bummer because like you look at it, I really think the PSP Go was a victim of timing, like because the UMD was a terrible, I was not a fan of the UMD drive.
Yeah, no.
It killed your battery life, it got scratched, it was like a weird medium. And like the PSP Go was perfect. I loved the fact that it was it didn't need that. You could use a memory stick. It set the path for a very underrated system, which is the Xperia Play, the combination of a phone and the PSP Go, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which completely bombed. I don't think you could even buy that. I'm sure you could buy it in North America. It was really hard to find. I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Especially the white one. If I recall, the PSP Go and the white model was very hard to find.
Oh, but, wasn't the white one, didn't that have like the really bad marketing behind it or something?
Oh, yeah, I believe so.
the
racially charged one, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you this, it was definitely a lot more practical than the Dingu. There was actually a handheld called the Dingu system. I don't know who named it.
So the Dingu and the Pandora are two systems I would love. The Dingu, I've never had one in my hand, but it looks like it's a Game Boy Micro, which I'm a huge, huge fan of.
Definitely has that look, yeah.
Yeah.
And has a, you know, again, it's another system meant to, I think, basically play games that you download from the internet. Maybe you don't pay for.
Maybe.
And then the Pandora is like, you take a laptop and you make it incredibly cute and tiny, and that's the Pandora. It's a super, it's a laptop that fits in your pocket, and it costs too much. You can buy them now. The new one, I think, is like the Dragon or something like that. It's the company that makes it, and it costs a fortune. And I really want one just because I like adorable little things. I think it's cute.
I can imagine just trying to type in this Nintendo DS style system with its little keyboard. Be like, hang on, I'm writing
it. And it runs like Windows. It runs a mobile version of Windows or something, which is awesome. Like, I want Windows on a keyboard system that's like the size of a phone. That's awesome.
Right, yeah. And it's definitely like an interesting like design for sure. And like it just seems like something that, I mean, obviously, like, back then, I mean, like, I feel like everyone was kind of trying to, like, figure out, like, what their design was going to be. Like, if you think, you know, if you think of, like, with the PSP Go, for example, like, having that kind of, like, that flip-up design and, like, you know, having flip down and everything. It was trying to, I guess, like, having, like, these portable game consoles almost, like, try to learn from, like, phones in a way as far as, like, how the designs were changing for that and, like, seeing what they could do with game consoles to make it work in that medium, you know?
Yeah. What is your take? I'd love to hear what you both think about the Vita, the PlayStation Vita. You
know, I love the Vita. Same. I love the Vita personally.
Same. Yeah. I mean, I think the Vita got an unfair shake from Sony. I think it should have stuck with it. I think it should have released more games for it, given it more support. I mean, this system was able to handle so much, and aside from the little back touch sensors, which I always thought were weird, the system was wonderfully built. And, you know, just being able to upgrade its memory, you know, play games on cartridge. I mean, I would like to think the PlayStation Vita set the standard for partially for what the Nintendo Switch has become.
The only, like, real black mark on the console, I will say, like, the only true black mark on the console is just, like, the memory, like the storage memory, you know? Like, like the cards that they need for, because that was, like, all proprietary. And it was, like, that was, like, absolutely necessary, really, if you're going to, like, have, like, any sort of storage on the console at all. So, I mean, like, the fact they had to do that and, like, pony up the money for that, and those things are expensive,
Not to mention, like, the 64-gig one was never – 64 gigabytes was never released here. You had to import it from Japan.
That's what I had to do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I did, too, and it pissed me off. I was like, why can't you sell it here? But, yeah, I mean, the PlayStation Vita, it got a number of great games, and, you know, is supported for some time there. You know, Gio Corsi, who, by the way, joined Delphine today, congratulations to him. He supported the system for years, and whenever there was a PlayStation press conference, he's like, and this game is coming to Vita, and some people in the crowd would go nuts that it was coming to Vita.
Three of them.
Yeah.
I like the Vita. I just felt like the system didn't have a good feel to it. It was a little too thick, you know.
Yes.
I like the feel of the PSP because it had that nice sort of place Walkman feel to it, and the Vita felt a little bloated to me. It felt like the Wii U, you know.
So what I had to get for my Vita actually was it was kind of like a case, but it wasn't like a fully formed case. It was just kind of like a handle case, basically. So it just like made it like, so it was like a lot more comfortable, basically, to grip the console itself for like long periods of time, because otherwise, like, by itself, I totally agree with that, absolutely.
You know, I think Brian really wants a PS Vita Go. I think that would be pretty cool if they made that happen.
I want that too, honestly.
With 64 gig internal memory, I would have bought 3 right there. Boom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they could now. I mean, obviously they wouldn't, but they, like, the technology's there. Mm-hmm. Such a bummer that, like, so many people backed out of portables, and, like, it's obviously it's great that Nintendo's still doing portables. I was a little let down. I actually haven't gone hands-on with a Nintendo Switch Lite, but I really wanted something a bit smaller. Mm-hmm. I felt like it's a little too big. I feel like
Switch Lite, or
I feel like they maybe were a little worried about going down to, like, you know, I don't know if you've seen some of the marketing pictures of people with it in their back pocket. I'm like, come on,
you want to Switch Micro, don't you? A Switch Micro,
I do. I so want.
I wouldn't mind seeing that either. That'd be kind of neat to see, just like a limited edition model. If it, like, as long as it takes the cartridges.
God, that'd be serious. But no, I just want something that's, like, you know, reasonable, not like, you know, oh, let's stuff it in our back pocket and have like 2/3 of it sticking out.
I mean, you wouldn't do that for like a $300 piece of like hardware.
I'm carrying it in a case in my backpack. I'm not sticking that thing in my backpack.
With a lot of padding around it, for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. You gotta be careful with my Switch. Are you nuts? I gotta play that at home. Then we also gotta bring up the Nintendo 3DS, the evolution of Nintendo's DS console with 3D. I mean, it was a neat effect with some of these games. I thought it was kind of cool with Super Mario 3D World and all that, but it just seemed kind of gimmicky to me, and I think Nintendo got that too. Hence the 2DS and then the 2DS XL, you know.
I mean, it was cool to use for Outrun, because I remember playing Outrun on the 3DS, and like it worked pretty well for that. But otherwise, yeah, it's a super gimmicky, and I turn it off like for everything, pretty much.
I play Power Drift on 3DS, and like, oh, I'm getting a headache. What's going on? All these little sprites coming at me. Anyway, go ahead, Brian.
No, I was going to say, I think probably one of Nintendo's worst redesigns in its history is the Nintendo 2DS.
Yeah. Oh, the 2DS.
Where you've got this,
the block.
It's like two different screen sizes. It's like oversized. It's a square. It's like they were like, let's get an intern to redesign the 3DS.
Hmm.
It just, Nintendo has such a great history of iterating. I don't know what the hell happened with the 2DS that the 2DS XL is fine. But the 2DS is just ridiculous.
The original, yeah. I mean, like, it was kind of meant to be, like, a more cost-effective, like, version of the 3DS, like, for kids for the most part, right?
But it was like a sandwich-shaped console. You couldn't even fit it in your back pocket. You had to carry it with you in your hand,
it's
or
so
the weird
and, like,
case.
Yeah. I mean, I know I know all the systems have two different screen sizes, but like when you don't have a fold, it just becomes so bad looking.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It just doesn't work out there. And then before the Nintendo Switch, we did have a couple others, companies trying their luck at like handheld innovations. The first one was Razer Switchblade. This was like a prototype that was like Nintendo DSi XL, which ran Windows 7, rest in peace, Windows 7, and had a multi-touch LCD screen, adaptive keyboard. It never came out, but I remember like some people trying it out at the Consumer Electronics Show when it was initially revealed in 2011.
Yeah. Mm. I would love to get my hands on one of those, as would a lot of people, just to have in my collection. And the NVIDIA Shield, I guess, is sort of
That's the other one, And that one was a little more popular, but it's just weird holding a controller while – it's sort of like – remember those attachments where you attach like a mobile phone to a controller with that little cradle?
It's nice like to try to do that. Yeah.
Well, it's like Stadia. I mean, you know, we're back there. It's funny because NVIDIA, it's obviously a different sort of approach, but – it's very similar in some levels, you know.
Yeah, but the difference is NVIDIA Shield works better than Stadia. They need to work on that performance thing.
But now, like, it seems like we're like in an age like where like being portable and playing games at home are kind of become like the same thing. You know, with like the Switch, and now you have like, I don't know, like a lot of like kind of like rumors or just like, you know, news out there anyway that like other companies are trying to basically do like a Switch-like device in that sense. Even with the PlayStation 5, like, you know, I've been hearing like a lot of rumors about that, like being like portable, like part portable, part home console. So I guess we'll wait and see on that, but like it does kind of make sense considering like how successful the Switch has been, and it is kind of amazing like what the Switch can do, honestly. So it's no wonder like why it's been like such a huge success for Nintendo.
I think it's very telling that so many people seem to rebuy games just so they can have it on a system that they can take with them.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say one more thing. We didn't really go over too much here, but like the mobile gaming scene is pretty insane as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a whole different barrel to climb into. But I mean, like you have games like Call of Duty and Mario Kart and all that. I mean, the market, according to an App Annie report, is estimated to make $100 billion on the mobile gaming market this year. I mean, that's insane. You know, Nintendo Switch is child's play compared to that, but it is great that a lot of people are looking to take their games on the go. And as such, the Nintendo Switch, you know, has sold, what, 43 million units?
I would say if you haven't demoed it, definitely you should check out Apple Arcade if you have an iPhone.
Yes. Yeah. Apple Arcade's really good.
Exit the Gungeon
for
the win. There's
so many good games on there. I mean, percentage-wise, it's actually probably a little on the low side. But there are some games on there where it's like, okay, this pays for the service. Like I would pay that much for this game.
Oh yeah, right. Exit the Gungeon by itself. I mean, I gotta give that game a shout out. It's so much fun, and they're releasing on a console soon enough. But hey, I'm enjoying an Apple Arcade right now, and the controller functionality is cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so cool. Yeah, I love that you could do that. So what I'm excited for, really excited for, are two. There are two things coming out this year: the Analog Pocket, which I cannot wait for. Oh my god, I'm
Jeremy
so...
Parrish has been tweeting about that nonstop. Yeah, he's been wanting that so bad.
Yes.
Oh man. So it's you have to buy I can't remember off the top of my head. You basically it comes with some support, but you have to buy like add-ons to be able to use different
cartridges or something like that. Yeah.
But I mean like the screen alone though, it almost looks like they really know how to bring out the best in like a Game Boy game or whatever games you play in it. I mean, and you can just set it in this neat looking station, and the size is just about perfect. It's micro sized, Brian, which is great.
Yeah, I know. That's why I like it. It looks a lot like the Game Boy Pocket. Like it's got that aesthetic, which is such a pretty little system. Obviously, better screen and, you know, much more powerful. But like it's got that, like, I don't know. I like that sort of. Again, going back to like Sony's designs around like some of the Walkman that they did when they were sort of making the transition to I've suddenly forgotten what their format was called. What was it called? That was before the UMD. It was for music. It wasn't a.
I know you're talking
but, you know, they about had
the mini discs or whatever it was.
Yeah, the mini discs.
Oh, yeah. I was all about the mini discs back then. Oh, my God.
And those players were gorgeous. Like the design, the industrial design on them were just gorgeous. And that's what this is. The Analog Pocket just looks so great. And then the Playdate.
Yeah. The Playdate, I was going to mention. Yeah.
I remember playing this at PAX Prime. This thing was weird. The system with a little crank on the side, but I like the games. Yeah.
It's going back to the electromechanical kind of like arcade games that you see back then.
Yeah. I want a fishing game for it. I just do.
That's a good idea, actually.
It makes sense.
And yeah, so it's neat that there's like these companies now that are doing, there's like two or three that are really putting out some interesting sort of handheld stuff. I'm so happy Analog has decided to do that. But then I've suddenly forgotten the name of the company that's been making those micro console or micro arcade machines.
I know you're talking about My Arcade, right?
Oh, My Arcade, yeah.
Yeah, we talked to them at E3 a while back. We actually had an interview with them, and they're doing really good with their little miniature arcade games, too. Even though they're, like, just NES games, it is pretty cool to own, like, Elevator Action and Contra and set them next to your bed.
Yeah. Right, and they've got, like, they've got these pocket players that they're coming out with now that have, like, they've had a couple out for a while, but yeah. They've got Galaga and Pac-Man, and I think that's kind of cool. Who is it? Are they the ones that are coming out with, I've suddenly forgotten the name of the company. There's someone that's coming out with another system that will play different.
Oh yeah. We talked about it a little while back. It was like,
Evercade.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. That's right.
And so, yeah, Evercade is basically, it's a handheld and they're going to have cartridges for systems. So like, I think they'll have like one or two for the Atari and one or two for the Intellivision, and they all fit in this system. It's a really kind of cool idea.
So it's kind of like pop in, pop out kind of thing? Or?
Yeah, the system doesn't look too bad either. It looks like it has that old school retro style design to it.
Yeah, though I have to say, and you guys know this, like until you get your hands on them, like they can look amazing, but if they don't get the buttons right and they don't get the D-pad right, that's just terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, but sure, hey, you know, sure. It's going to have Earthworm Jim. I mean, that's got to count for something.
That's something.
That's something, yeah.
Three systems coming out this year that are old.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, have like that old school kind of like mentality to it for sure. Yeah.
So amazing.
And we also have like a bunch of listener responses here. So I had to limit this down to like a few here just because we had like a lot of good responses in regards to favorite handheld consoles. So starting off here with PacDan16, who's over at our Discord. So be sure to check out our show notes to see like how you can join in on the Discord and talk about retro gaming with us. But PacDan here says the GBA SP backlit version was an amazing piece of gaming tech for its time. It could play three generations of Game Boy games and has a fantastic game library. It still holds up well today, especially with modern flash carts enhancing the experience, even allowing you to play homebrew games. So I know that's like something he's really, really big into, the flash carts and all that. So really cool. Brent Blackley, who says, I feel lame saying the Switch Lite, but it's true. I've been gaming since the 80s, and it's the best one I've played. So the Switch Lite you can't really go wrong with, or just Switch in general. So there's also Russ Retro Talis, who says, Trojan Horse by Gacken. I played it to death. I played to death on the rarer Princetronic version. I now have all variations and all three of the set boxed and mint. The other two were Towing Rescue and the impossible to find Fishing. So, Brian, I was kind of curious if you know about Trojan Horse by Gacken.
No, I don't. Like, what? Is that an LCD game? It sounds like an LCD.
I think game. It looks like an LCD game. I'll see if I can. Or Robert, if you don't mind pulling up a. Picture
I got it here. For a minute there, I almost pulled
up. I've got to do a little humble brag. Tomorrow or sometime this week, I'm going to be getting in a Invaders of the Mummy's Tomb that I won on eBay.
Oh, nice.
It's an LCD. So Bandai made some LCD games, and there were just a handful they made that were solar-powered. And this is one of those. Came out in 82. But yeah, I see this. Yeah. These are the game A, game B idea of my first handheld system was a Game & Watch game called Popeye.
Oh, yeah.
which doesn't take a lot. There's not a lot you need to do to explain what it is.
Right. It's Popeye.
And you're dodging cans that are being thrown by Bluto. And then I think Olive Oil is dropping little cans of.
She drops like hearts or something, at least in the arcade game.
Anyway. Yeah,
yeah. She like throws them out and they float down. You're basically going between three floors. It looks a lot like this, like Trojan Horse, where it's a single screen and you have, I think there were two buttons, and then there was a game A and a game B, which were basically the same game. Like, they're always basically the same.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And I found a nice little challenge one here before we get to the rest of them. I found an Afterburner handheld game from Tiger Electronics with a built-in flight stick.
Oh, wow.
Nice. Yeah, this. Tiger, like, I'm not a big fan of the Tiger Electronic games because they seem to fall in this era, like, after the LCD games.
Yeah.
they were like, they were still sort of LCD games. They didn't put a lot of energy into them, it seemed like, and they weren't great. And it was like, they started hitting around the time that the Game Boy is out, and it's like, they were sort of, I don't know. I don't think they were as good as the, yeah, so this came out in 87, which is just a couple years before Game Boy, so.
I mean, the Tiger games weren't, like, good by any means, but they were certainly popular. Like, so many people had them because cheap way of gaming on the go.
And I'll tell you, I would love to get this Afterburner as a collectible just to say, like, hey, look at this flight stick.
Yeah, you totally should. It looks cool anyway, so, yeah.
I've got a couple of old, like, there's a... Tommy made a bunch of games in the mid to late 70s that were mechanical electronic games. So, like, Blip, which is the one I have, is essentially Pong. But the way it works is it has an LED that lights up that's the ball. But then the thing that actually moves the ball back and forth is you have to wind it. You wind it in the back.
Oh, okay.
And then you can hear it unwinding, and that's actually physically moving something in this sort of tiny little handheld.
Like behind the shell, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a light connected to it. It's really weird. Wow. But they made like a series of those. Tiger made a couple also. They had a game called Rocket Pinball that I have that is this weird... another sort of weird amalgam of like just using LEDs. It was all, you know, pre-LCD. Some of those games are like really, really weird. But I'm sorry, I know you were going through emails.
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah. yeah, so like with that, there's Dave Goodwell who says, the Cobalt Blue GBA SP, absolute perfection. So I know there's a lot of love for the SP there.
It's a good system.
Absolutely, yeah. Keith Coles, who says Atari Lynx, extremely advanced at the time with both 8 and 16-bit architecture, color screen, and multiple dedicated processors. The most technically advanced handheld at its release, but let down by Atari with poor marketing and poor software development support. So,
and let down by Robert, who didn't mention it.
And that too, yes. How dare you, Robert? How dare you?
Well... It's been a great run on this podcast. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, you got to hang up your retro gaming card.
Ah, well. Man.
Oh, well.
Always no links
for
toads.
You this Christmas. Always. Yeah, exactly. then there's Mick Yexley, who says, 3DS, still play Mario Kart Online multiplayer now. Awesome. And I'm 54 playing since mid-70s Pong. So he definitely has a lot of history there, for sure. Then there's David McIntosh, who says Game Gear with the TV plugin, as we mentioned there, with the TV tuner. Dave Boldosser, who says my Nintendo 3DS XL plays my retro games. Just wish they would have offered more, which I totally 100% agree. That's a big reason why I love the Vita, actually, because of the fact that you have so many PS1 games available to play on there. And I have quite the PS1 collection just on my Vita, which is like really cool just to, you know, have. Just be able to turn on my Vita and just play it right there. So if the 3DS added like, you know, added more like Nintendo games on there, that would have been amazing. But unfortunately, they did not put too much support, and not at least as much support as I feel like a lot of people would have liked to see. Then there's Todd Allen, who says, I grew up on the Game Boy. Playing Tetris in the backseat was my jam. And I think a lot of people have that kind of memory for sure, playing Game Boy in the backseat, especially if it's like nighttime and you have to like rely on the like street lights or like lights outside, whatever, to like get the backlight.
The fear of like it getting darker and darker. And then you realize suddenly you're like, I can't see what I'm doing.
Right, exactly. Victoria Del Castillo, who says WonderSwan Crystal, and we didn't mention much about WonderSwan on here.
Yes.
But I know I am in talks with someone, I won't mention who yet, but someone, in order to do a WonderSwan themed episode for sure in the future. But yeah, the WonderSwan, there's definitely kind of like a wealth of like, you know, like really cool, like just consoles and just like a lot of cool history like behind that. So definitely stay tuned for more of that. Mark Rose, who says, before Game Boy, we had the Tiger LCD games. I had a Street Fighter one, wasted many, many batteries on it. So,
yes.
Yeah. So again, I had like some Tiger toys. I think, like the Tiger games I had a Batman one and I can't remember Double Dragon. I think I had
something
as well.
Like that,
Yeah. Double Dragon. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. I had like a few of them. I remember, I think there was like a Bart Simpson one I had too. It was kind of like based on Bart Simpson versus the Space Mutants, but Tiger version basically. So then there is Will Mark Cooler, who says Turbo Express all the way. We definitely gave some love to Turbo Express here. Brett Cummins, who says Game Boy Advance SP when me and my eyes were much younger. Nikki Izzo says Atari Lynx, but Baseball and Microvision probably got the most gameplay. That was fun as hell. So, Brian, I don't know if you play much Baseball and Microvision at all.
No, I mean, I played it a little bit, but yeah, I'm not really into sports, even the electronic kind.
Yeah. Also that picture that you put up there, is that from your own collection or?
Yeah. So this is a little outdated. It's got some systems, it's missing some of the systems I have now. It's actually missing a lot of the systems I have now, but yeah. Actually this is the wrong one. So this is an outdated picture. One thing I was going to mention, I got a little obsessed for a short period of time, trying to figure out what was the first chess game to come out that was portable but did not include physical pieces. Because there were plenty of them, as you can see in this picture, I have one. There were plenty of systems that use like the little peg system where you would push your piece into these holes and that was the game. But I was trying to figure out like what was the very first computer chess portable gaming system.
Digital and I believe... version of it, yeah.
I believe the first one, I have one. Unfortunately, the LCD is almost completely burnt out on it, so you can barely play it. But I believe it's Mattel's Computer Chess, which came out in 1980.
Oh.
And is such a cool little system. It also has the dorkiest box art you will ever see in your entire life for a video game system. I can't remember. It's a very famous chess player. And he's on the box, and I'm looking it up right now.
Okay.
Oh, it's Pandolfini.
Okay.
Let me show you. I shouldn't laugh at him because he's a brilliant chess player. But
oh, this guy. Yeah, I've seen his face before. Yeah.
But like, look at that system.
Yeah,
isn't that such a cool looking system?
That system. Nothing. Look at his hair. That's rad hair right there.
Oh yeah.
I know. 80s. Yeah. So yeah, it's such a great box, but like it came out in 1980. That's a cool little, I don't know. There's just something about that design that I just absolutely love.
It's pretty neat, honestly. Yeah, honestly, it feels like it should be right next to like one of those like old like Simon toys, you know?
Yes, so. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's Mattel, which is funny because they obviously, this is them making the leap from the LED games to LCD games.
Now, why does the box itself look like it's shaped like a condom box, like a box you get like condoms?
I have no idea. Actually, when I bought this, it came with the box and the instructions, which is awesome.
Mm.
And so I have the box stored away, but it is exactly what you think. It's like the box, and then it has that thing sticking
like
up
the
in
tab,
the back.
Yeah,
yeah, like you would hang it, except there's no hole to hang it. So
right, but it's like his face on there too. But like imagine like his face, but it's like a Trojan condoms like a box.
Yeah,
or something.
I guess like he was so famous. I don't know. I find that hard to believe, but it was very important for them to have like that thing sticking up, so you could have this ridiculous like bland quote.
Right.
He's like, plays superb chess.
Yeah, offers unique features and is totally portable.
I am the national chess master.
Right. That's amazing. All right, well, thanks for sharing that. then there's also Michael Panagiotis, who says, while I loved my Game Gear when I was a kid, I would say the DS Lite is the best handheld since it has the DS and GBA slots. So that's definitely fair. Fair assessment there. And last one here, and I have like a picture to go along with this as well, because I definitely wanted to show you guys this. Vince Walling, who says, for me though, it was this. And let me just upload that picture for you guys here. Basically, it's a Frogger portable machine.
Those machines are great.
Yeah.
It's like a yellow Frogger machine. It has like the one stick, and basically that stick is like has you like move around the frog. So, yeah.
Yeah, there were, I forgot, was that? I forgot who made those, but they made a whole line. They had a Pac-Man. They had a bunch that came out that were all with those same sticks. They had the little tiny joystick, and they were like, you know, those are the sort of things that like your rich friend had, and you were like, man, I wish I could get one of those.
Right. Yeah. So you got like the Tiger electronic toys.
Yeah. Instead. Right. Exactly. You're like, oh, I guess I'll just play this thing.
I'm a little surprised nobody's really mentioned like the Coleco line. I think one big one that stood out was Zaxxon, because it had like the pre-lit background there, and then had the mirror thing just for the ship image, so it looked like it was in 3D.
And thank you to everyone for sharing your favorite portable gaming consoles there. So like a lot of fun there, a lot of good responses there for sure. So
I've got to mention one other oddity. there was, I can't remember if it was Galaxian or Galaga, but there was a portable, it came out in the 80s that I was, I got as a birthday present. And the thing that was weird about it was that it was a head-to-head system. Now, if you're familiar with Galaga or Galaxian, that isn't a thing. Like, you can't do that. So there were two ways you could play it. You could take turns, or you could play as the aliens, which was so weird. It's like, and it was this weird, like, gray system. And one of these days, I'm going to go buy it again. You know, as with most childhood toys, you know, I sold it at some point, or it was sold in a garage sale or something. But oh man, I played it so much, I actually started hating Galaxian and Galaga because I just played it too much.
Got burnt out. But it was, yeah,
it was such a weird little system, though.
Man, all right. All right, so that's going to move on to a game code from you here, Robert.
Yep, I'm giving away a PlayStation Vita code as well. It's for a game that some of you may not be familiar with because it's more like a visual novel sort of game, but it's called Caller X Malice. It was released back in 2016 and published by Idea Factory, and definitely one of those weird little titles. It follows a character by the name of Ichika Hoshino, who is patrolling a part of Tokyo. She becomes attacked, and a collar with poison is placed around her neck, and she basically comes involved with a story that involves around an X-Day incident, which is being investigated by former police officers. So it's a very interesting sort of romance. I mean, it's not my kind of game, and I'm sure somebody out there is going to enjoy this one. So here is the code for PlayStation Vita. It is PC87BJNG. LNGQ. That's for Caller X Malice on PlayStation Vita. If you do redeem that, let us know at twitter.com/argpodcast.
Indeed. And yeah, that's basically Arcast episode 190 in the books. But just want to give like a shout out here first to our patrons, Francisco Limas and Mac the Ball. So thank you very much, guys, for helping support the show. And if you too would also like to support the show, you could check us out at patreon.com/arcast, and you can see all the different perks and such that you can like buy into. You know, whether if you want to be like a be like a guest on the show, pick a topic, or like, you know, even just kind of like, you know, chip in like a dollar or two just to kind of like help us out. So we definitely appreciate all the support that you guys give us. So,
and on top of that, before we close out here, I did want to make an announcement here. We are going to PAX East. I'm going to be flying in from Denver and staying somewhere, probably a box behind the convention center.
An alleyway somewhere, yeah. So Boston.
Well, it's Boston. I mean, how cold is it going to be? And I'm like, well, I'm an idiot who asked that. But no, we have been signed on for a panel. Our buddy over there at Greenlit Content, sorry about that. She is hosting a panel called 35 Years of Tetris, and we will be on it, myself and David, along with our buddy Jeremy Parrish, as well as Brendan Groom and Chris Souza. It will take place Sunday, March 1st at 2 o'clock at the Albatross Theater. We will be talking about all sorts of games. We'll be doing the music. We'll be doing trivia. Morgan is supposedly making a Tetris business suit to wear for the panel, which that'll be fun to watch. So come on, stop by if you're at the show. It's going to be a totally fun panel, as we usually host.
For sure. And we'll definitely be talking about more about panels that we're like part of later on, for sure. I know I'm still kind of finalizing some things with a couple of other panels I'm part of, but definitely stay tuned for more information on that. And Brian, I should ask you, actually, are you going to PAX East? Are you doing any panels or anything?
No, I don't know right now. I'm not doing any panels. I'm not sure if I'll go to East. Maybe I will. It's weird. I'm doing a lot of consulting now, so I'm not really working for any one person. So that means that I don't need to go, which is something I haven't been in a situation like this in like more than probably 2 decades.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I haven't decided. Maybe I'll go.
Yeah, you totally should. And we'll like hang out and like play some, yeah. I don't know, play some like, was the play date or whatever. So
I've never been to a show where I actually have free time to do what I want to do. I need one of those.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Brian, where can people go in order to find you online?
You can go to Twitter, and I'm just Crescenti B on Twitter, or it's not updated that often, but my personal website is padpixel.com, and that's just sort of a storage room of all of my writing.
Very cool. And yeah, so hopefully we'll see you at PAX East. Hopefully we'll see all of you at PAX East as well, the listeners there. And yeah, we'll definitely have like a, you know, like a number of other shows like before then. But yeah, just want to say that first and foremost. So that is ARGcast episode 190, basically in the books. And if you'd like to follow the ARGcast on Twitter, we are at ARG Podcast. Same thing with Facebook, facebook.com/ARG Podcast. And you can find me on Twitter at The Guilty Man.
Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/TheDCD. You can also visit my YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheDCD1. I'm doing some retro-based videos based on pickups I make over the weekends, so be sure to check that out as well. And be sure to check out my work at GamePer.com and PCInvasion.com. And if you'd like to send us any feedback, opinions, retro games, or topics for us to cover, or anything at all, really, you can email us at argcast@retrozap.com. And be sure to check out retrozap.com for all sorts of other amazing podcasts. It's your home away from home if you're crazy about Star Wars, Animaniacs, or pop culture in general. There's also us with ARGcast, so be sure to find us on iTunes to subscribe, give us 5 stars, and tell your neighbors. We're also on Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play Music, so there's absolutely no reason to not follow another retro gaming podcast. Okay, and that is episode number 190 in the books. Until next time, keep it retro. And also, if somebody offers you a Cybico system, make sure they pay you for it, because you shouldn't pay a cent for essentially a 9,000 button handheld.
And you probably shouldn't like do business with them anyway if they look anything like a computer chess player. So just saying.
Yes. Here, it's a condom box. It's really cool. Look,
you gotta stay safe, Robert. You know, it's a rough world out there.
You never know. I mean, with a hairstyle like that, he probably got a lot of girls back in the day.
Oh, he gets all the girls. Absolutely. Yeah, with those chess skills.
He's a chess player. He's a grandmaster. Come on.
He's a grandmaster. That's right.
He's a grandmaster of looks, is what he is. Thanks again for coming on, Brian, and we will see you guys next week on the ARG Podcast.
Catch you later.